That we have a quorum.
Thank you. In that case, we will begin the Budget and Finance Committee meeting. And Marcy, would you please call the roll?
On the roll for the Budget and Finance Committee meeting of February 27th, 2019, Director Abe-Koga, Director Canepa,
here.
Director Chavez, Director Hudson,
here.
Director Mandelman, Director Mitchoff, here. Director Ross, Director Sinks, Director Wagon Connect, here. Committee Vice Chair Bowders,
here.
Committee Chair Groom,
present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Would you now all join us in the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation,
under God,
indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to make a public comment?
I do have two cards, Madam Chair.
Two cards? Mm-hmm. Would you please call their names?
Yes. Kevin Buchan and Devin Richards.
Is this thing on?
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Groom and members of the subcommittee. My name is Kevin Buchan. I'm with the Western States Petroleum Association. About a year ago, we came to this committee and we talked a little bit about trying to create a little bit more transparency in how staff code their time, especially specific to refinery permits and different activities that your staff does. We also talked a little bit about fees, and which your staff have issued the fee rule for amendments. What we'd like to do is get an update from maybe from your staff on where things are on the staff coding issue. If you remember, there was a budget category that was pretty vague, and we were just hoping to establish a little bit more transparency on that. In addition, especially with the issuance of the draft fee regulation, kind of brought to mind with the refineries that under Schedule X, which are monitoring the community monitoring fees, the past 3 years the refineries have contributed just with the five of them about $3 million. And yet, to our knowledge, there hasn't been any visible change or efforts that we have seen in establishing these monitors, so we're just kind of hoping to have an update on that.
All right. We will schedule that for the next meeting. Be All very right. happy to do that.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Devin Richards. I'm with the California Council for Environmental and Economic Balance. I think I was going to speak to agenda item 7, but I'll just give this comment now as this is kind of just a process comment. Today, I'm asking that stakeholders be able to return to you for detailed discussions on the budget and proposed fees. As staff has described in past presentation, permit fees from 2008 to 2018 have more than doubled, and many of the fee schedules continue to increase despite being above the 85% cost recovery target that the board has set, with some increasing even after hitting more than 100% cost recovery. SEEB asks that stakeholders have the opportunity to discuss with the committee fees, cost recovery, and level of service being rendered across district programs. To do so, we need the background details contained in the proposed budget, which won't be released until after Regulation 3 comments are due. Comments on Regulation 3 are due to the district on March 21st, yet the proposed budget will not be released until March 22nd. That's a day later. This means stakeholder comments on the proposed fee amendments will be made without knowledge to the programs that they fund at the district. It is our preference to work through our issues with staff in this committee rather than the full board hearing where opportunity to comment is limited. Our request is that the Regulation 3 comment deadline be postponed until at least a week after the proposed budget is made available. We've made this request in years past that we'd like consideration of Regulation 3 to be done in parallel with the proposed budget. We think this makes sound and balanced fiscal policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McKay, Mr. Bunger, is there any reason why we couldn't do that?
Let Mr. McKay go first. So, Chair Groom, we do present the fees and the budget for the first time at the same meeting. That will be the March meeting. and our ability to release the budget a day or two earlier, I think, is reasonable. We can try to do that.
Okay. There would be no rules in our bylaws that wouldn't allow us to do that?
No.
Okay, great. All right. Any other public comment? Okay. So let us go to item number 3, which is the approval of the minutes of January 23rd. All in favor?
Aye.
Excellent. Item number 4 is the Air District Financial Audit Report for fiscal year ending 2018.
Thank you, Chair Groom, members of the committee. The Air District has a policy of changing its auditors every 3 years. So for the first time, we're welcoming today Simpson & Simpson, who performed our audit this year, and we're grateful for all the hard work they did here over the last several months. We'll be hearing today from Mr. Joe Musa, partner with Simpson & Simpson.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning, committee members. Again, my name is Joe Musa, partner with Simpson & Simpson CPAs. So what we're going to be doing today is presenting to you the results of the fiscal year 2018 financial audit, in addition to the single audit as well. So going over the agenda, we're going to talk about the required communications as it pertains to what are we supposed to be communicating to those charged with governance. And it really gives us an opportunity to discuss with the board the results or committees, the results of the audit, and it allows us to be able to have access to the committee as well as an independent body. We'll go over some of the results of the financial audit, the single audit, and then I'll certainly open it up for any questions that you guys may have. All right, so starting off, what is SAS 114? Statement on Auditing Standard 114 is a requirement that auditors should always present to any committee or governing body the results of the audit. And without us having access to the committee, it really stops us from having independence. And it really allows management of any entity to have control over the results and potentially for them not to disclose certain items to committees. It's just a general idea behind why this is a requirement. So it stipulates some of the required items that we're supposed to communicate to all bodies and governing bodies. So I'm just going to go through those very quickly. If you look at item number 1, what is our responsibility under what we call generally accepted accounting principles or accounting standards? And I'm going to go through some of these items. So firstly, internal control. Internal control is a very important aspect to all of our audits, and our responsibility is to review the district's internal control so that we can prepare an efficient and effective audit plan. Some of the areas that we look at is cash disbursement, payroll processing, procurement actions, and in addition to cash receipts. So really our goal is to be able to rely on your internal controls, because that provides us the opportunity to either decrease our substantive testing at year end and have a heightened level of assurance over the district's operations. Next, we review and we prepare audit procedures in order to provide an entity with reasonable but not absolute assurance that your financial statements are free of a material misstatement. And that's really what we're looking for, right? Are the financial statements that we're presenting, is it free from a material error? And our goal is to be able to provide you with that level of, again, reasonable but not absolute assurance. And then finally, we perform tests of compliance, laws, and regulations that may have a direct impact on your financial statements. And then really getting to the meat of why I'm here is we provide an opinion over your financial statements, and really kind of cut to the chase, just to give everybody the general idea. The results of the audit is that you received an unmodified opinion, and essentially what we call that is the highest, cleanest level of an opinion that an entity can obtain on their financial statement. So we'll review a little bit more on the type of opinions that we do provide over your financial statements, your internal control, and over your single audit as well. So moving on, our responsibility also is to review the Air District's significant accounting policies and to make sure that those policies are in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, or what we call GAAP. You'll find in note 1 to the notes of the financial statements a summary of those policies. It's about 3 or 4 pages long. Our goal is to review those policies to make sure that they are in accordance with GAAP. A couple of highlights. We're going to talk a little bit today about GASB 75, which is essentially a change in the way that all government entities must account for their OPEB plan. And then you'll find that this kind of new action and new pronouncement is very similar to GASB 68. So a lot of the verbiage that we're going to be using, you guys are going to be very familiar with it. The accounting treatment for it is very similar as well. So other than the change in accounting for OPEB, there were no other significant changes to the district's accounting policies from the prior year. I'd like to also report to the committee that all significant transactions have been recognized in the appropriate period. So that's also very important to know. Now, moving on to estimates. And estimates is going to have a big role also in GASB 75, GASB 68. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But our responsibility is to review estimates that have a material impact on your financial statements and to review the assumptions, to review how the district arrived at those estimates, and to essentially conclude whether or not those estimates are reasonable. Just to walk through a couple of very sensitive items. First item is useful life of capital assets. Really, determining a useful life of a capital asset is going to impact a couple of things. Number one, your depreciation expense on a yearly basis is going to be driven by whatever amortization that the air district adopts. And number two, what is the balance of the assets on your government-wide at the end of the year? So when we're talking about estimates, obviously any useful life use is an estimate. But there are certain standards that we can follow. We compare kind of the policy that the district uses to other government entities to make sure that there's transparency, and it's kind of all driving together. So we'd like to conclude that we are in accordance with the estimates used by management concerning your capital assets. So essentially what we're saying is that the estimates are reasonable. And then again, we get to the meat of what are the major estimates that are really hitting the financial statements in a material way. It's essentially your pension and OPEB plan. Your actuaries with CalPERS and your actuaries for your OPEB, which is McLeod-Watts, they are preparing actuarial assumptions. They're putting together estimates. And every single year, they kind of adopt a report that they provide to the Air District to say, here's our estimate for total pension liability, total OPEB liability. And what we do as auditors is we review their reports, we review their credentials, we look over the assumptions that they use to make sure that they are reasonable and properly supported. And then you'll see there, you know, it's driven, if you look at your financial statements or government-wide, deferred outflows of resources, deferred inflows of resources, pension expense, OPEB expense, and then the big ticket item, your net pension liability, net OPEB liability. All of those are driven by estimates. And very much so, we look at those with a fine-tooth comb because that's going to be changing each year, right? It's such a moving target because of the nature of those estimates. So we'd like to provide assurance, or we'd like to provide reasonable assurance to the board that we have reviewed those estimates and we find that they're reasonable. Now, throughout an audit, there could be instances where we find an error through our audit in terms of certain journal entries that are proposed. We'd like to report to the board that there was just one adjustment that was proposed that was not material that the district did book on their financial statements. So that covers the corrected misstatements, and there were no uncorrected misstatements. Sometimes we could propose an adjustment. Management may decide not to book it. We usually only allow that in instances where the adjustments are immaterial, but there were none this year. And then what I was referring to earlier in terms of internal control, we also opine on your internal controls. And we'd like to provide the committee with a report that there were no significant deficiencies identified in the district's internal controls. Moving on to the final three items, there could be instances. Oh, yeah, please. After you.
So thank you, Madam Chair. What would be several significant deficiencies? What would that look like?
Sure. So, for instance, in your cash disbursement, if we find that your policy is that there are certain individuals who approve expenses before they're paid, and then we find that those approvals are not found in any of the expenses that are being booked on the financials, that's a significant deficiency. That may also lead to a material weakness in financial statements, right, where we're not really comfortable with the process that's being taken place. I'll just give you one more example. For instance, payroll. If we're finding that there are certain rates that the employees are being paid, that doesn't tie back to the personnel action form. That's a major issue, right, because you want to make sure that the district is following a process to pay employees the correct rate. So those would be examples of what we would know. Yeah. Moving on, last couple of items here on SAS 114. There could be instances where a pronouncement is issued and there could be disagreements in how we interpret those pronouncements. I'd like to report to the committee that there were no such disagreements. There were no difficulties in dealing with management. And to our knowledge, there were no consultants or other accountants utilized in conjunction with our audit. And then finally, we did request management to make certain representations that they did provide us as of the date of the audit report, February 13, 2019. All right, so let's get to the fun stuff here in terms of the results of the basic financial statement. So as I stated earlier, the Air District, the opinion over the financial statements is an unmodified opinion. Again, that is the cleanest opinion that an organization can obtain as a result of an audit. Financial highlights, I'm going to go through, obviously, GASB 75 in a little detail. Government-wide financial statements you'll find in the tab there in your report. That really kind of simulates the financials of a private organization, private entity, to kind of give you an idea in terms of the long-term assets and long-term liabilities of the Air District. And then we have fund financials, which break down two of the major funds you have are the General Fund and Special Revenue Fund. All right. Now, GASB 75, in the same manner as GASB 68, requires air districts to look at, or requires any government entity to look at, your total pension liability. If I may, I'd like to refer you to page 48 of your report. It's going to give you a breakdown of what is the makeup of the air district's net OPEB liability. When we're talking about, for instance, your total OPEB liability of the overall plan, that's determined by your actuaries. That's where we're talking about estimates, assumptions. That's how we come up with that figure. And then what we do from there is we look at the Air District's fiduciary net position. Really what we're looking at is how much money do you have in the plan that can kind of counteract what your total pension, total OPEB liability is. And whatever is left over is essentially now going to be the responsibility of the Air District. It's going to be on the face of your government-wide financial statement. So if you go back to the government-wide financial statements, you'll find that it's about $27 million with regards to your net OPEB liability at the end of the year. And one of the requirements is to say, okay, let's go back to last year and restate the beginning balance. So they require us to go back as of June 30, 2017, and say, if GASB 675 had been implemented, how much would your net OPEB liability be at that time? So you had about last year about $4.1 million. On last year's face of the government-wide financial statements. What we're saying is that this year, when we analyze that balance, it should have been $21.5 million higher. Okay, so your liability should have been higher. Obviously, this is a very big implementation in the same way that you find that big number here on the current year. So what we go ahead, what we do is we restate the financial statements. You'll find that in the notes to the financials as well, so that your beginning balance is now $144.5 million in terms of your net position. And then we apply, you know, those same kind of methodology to the current year. So essentially what you're finding on your government-wide financial statements this year is the balance of your net OPEB liability as of June 30th, 2018. Now moving on, your net position overall at the end of the year was $172.3 million. One of the main reasons for the increase is due to additional funds that you receive for air quality grants. So that's kind of, that's also going to be a reason why your fund balance increases as well. So moving on here to your combined governmental fund balance, it saw an increase of about $44.96 million. Again, that is related to air quality grants that you received. And then finally, looking at your general fund, I just wanted to make a note, $75 million of your fund balance is what gets carried over to the next year. You'll find there the breakdown of the various fund balance classifications. So that kind of covers some of the financial highlights. Getting over here through our opinions. Now, what opinions do we provide? We provide you an opinion over your internal control over financial reporting. That's a very critical thing that we look at, and that's what I was referring to earlier about looking at the Air District's internal control. So we'd like to report to the committee that there were no material weaknesses and no significant deficiencies noted. Also, we opine on compliance. Remember, I talked a little bit about compliance over laws and regulations. We noted no instances of noncompliance. And then finally, we look at your single audit, which is essentially your federal funding. Our opinion over your federal funding this year is that there were no instances of noncompliance noted with regards to your BioWatch program. That was essentially the major fund or major program that was audited in the current year. And we also opine over the internal control over compliance as well. And we'd like to report that there were no material weaknesses or significant deficiencies. Finally, last couple of items here. There were no findings noted in the current year. There were no findings noted last year for us to follow up on. So that's a good sign as well. That kind of concludes my presentation. I'm very open to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Questions? Director Mitchell?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I actually have a question about policies, and this is not a criticism of staff, I sit on a number of regional bodies. Our attendance record and or minutes constitute our attendance at these records. As you'll see, we all have these green forms, and I appreciate needing to have documentation to follow up. But my question to you, and it may be one for you to consider to talk with staff about in the future, is reviewing the Air Board's policies, because frankly, I find them a little bit outdated. When I sit on four other regional bodies, and I'm looking at this as in form of automation and saving staff time and being environmental, because the majority of us come from the same place every time we come to a meeting and we have the same expenses. I'm not talking about when folks go on trips and have to attach receipts and what have you, but this simplifies the process for staff, and it just would seem to me, as you're looking at management practices and what have you, I would like that looked into, because I think it takes a lot of our staff time to be processing all of this paperwork that could be automated.
Well noted.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. Thank you very much. Congratulations to our financial team.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Yes. And may I ask for a report back in the near future after you've talked?
Karen, we will schedule that for a future meeting.
Thank you. That's all I was asking.
Okay, I lost my agenda. So now we will go to item number 5, which is the second quarter financial report for the fiscal year ending 2019. Stephanie, welcome.
Good morning. Oops, sorry. Okay, so today I will present the second quarter general fund financial results, which covers the period from July 1st through December of 2018. My presentation, I will provide an overview of revenues recognized, expenditures incurred, and the district's investment portfolio for the second quarter. I will also provide an overview of the general fund balance and outstanding liabilities, and I will review the purchasing report for vendors exceeding $100,000. And then I will conclude with responses to questions raised at the prior budget and finance meeting. So slide 3 provides an overview of the general fund revenues and compares it to the 2019 budget that was adopted. Overall, major revenues recognized during the second quarter represent 67% of the budget. This next slide, slide 4, provides a year-to-year comparison looking at the revenues recognized in the same period of 2018 and comparing it to 2019 actuals. And looking at those significant differences, we see that there is a significant increase in permit fees in 2019. And that's due to two factors, one being the increase in the fee schedule that was effective at the beginning of the fiscal year. And second, we also had an adjustment to some of the fee payers' anniversary date in order to comply with Rule 1215. The anniversary date had to be moved from August to December, which resulted in capturing 4 additional months of fees. So the billing period for the fee payers for this year actually ended up being 16 months instead of 12. This is a one-time adjustment, so next year the billing period will be set back to a 12-month billing cycle. This next slide, slide 5, summarizes the general fund expenditures and compares it to the 2019 budget. Actual expenditures represent 53% of the budget. In this slide, we also wanted to point out office acquisition, which was not a part of the initial budget, but was also approved by the board for the purchase of the Richmond site and additional space at this office. This next slide provides a prior year comparison of expenditures for the same period. And as you can see, salaries is higher, and that's due to, one, increased staffing in 2019, and there was also a COLA that was effective at the beginning of the year. As you can see, benefits also increase, and as the staffing increase, so will benefits. We also have capital outlay as 1.1 lower in 2019, and that's basically just due to timing of when capital purchases are made. This slide provides a snapshot of the district's investment account balances with San Mateo County at December of 2018. The district balance represents of $240 million represents 4.2% of the $5.8 billion in the investment pool. The interest earned for the second quarter was 2.2%. This slide, slide 8, shows the 2017 and 2018 audited fund balance, as well as the 2019 projected fund balance, which is estimated at $33.3 million. In this slide, we also include the unfunded liabilities for our pension plan, which is at the bottom of this table, and our OPEB plan, which totals about $93 million. We've also included here the certificate of participation notes, which was the purchase that was made for this building. And the estimated principal and interest payments on that note is about $27 million. Before I begin this slide, I will have Jeff introduce this section.
Thank you, Stephanie. I just want to provide a little historical context here. About 8 years ago, staff noticed that there's a perfectly reasonable policy to go to the board for contracts over $100,000. But we realized that technically some things were over $100,000 and weren't getting to the board. And those are things that we just assumed the board wouldn't want to see, like PG&E bill, things like that. In addition, we noticed, well, sometimes you might pay a vendor some money in 1 month and pay them some more money in another month for something else. And that might accrue over $100,000, and there could be an optics issue there. So we thought, well, what do we want to do with this? We could modify our policies perhaps so that we have some set-asides if some things don't go to the board, but that didn't seem like the right way to go. So we went the other direction and said, We came to the board with a change to the proposed change to the admin code, which was accepted, so that for items like this, we would include them in the quarterly report, as Stephanie's doing today. Just anything that's over $100,000 that the board didn't see, we'll just show in the quarterly report. And for a number of years, that's not got a lot of attention. But some good questions came up in the last meeting, and so Stephanie's going to talk a little bit about that.
Great. So before I actually talk about that, this is the second quarter cumulative vendor payments that exceed $100,000 without board approval. And as Jeff indicated, majority of these are, of course, utilities, but we've got also benefits here for employees, and some of the other operating costs that we have to continue our day-to-day activities here at the district. I wanted to speak to the next two slides. This was a part of the request that was made. This particular list was from the fourth quarter report, and this captures basically all the vendor payments that exceeds $100,000 for fiscal year 2018. So this basically shows the cumulative payments made for the entire fiscal year from the prior year. And so this particular slide, we've categorized the vendors into five categories. Vendors with the letter A, noted in the comment column that says RFP comment, are vendors where brokers perform regular reviews of these insurance plans for competitive pricing. The vendors with letter B are not under the district's purview, and the competitive pricing
is
done.
I'm sorry, could you go back to the previous slide?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I didn't realize I clicked that. Sorry. I'm sorry. So, I'm sorry. Vendors with the letter B are not really under the district's purview, and their competitive pricing is done by another agency. So, for example, you see here CalPERS, who conducts the health and dental insurance review for the district. And you also have here MTC, which is listed under Bay Area Headquarters Authority, and they handle the services acquired through the authority. Vendors with the letter C are either a sole source vendor or there are limited providers for this service. And then we also have vendors with the letter D, and these are vendors the district uses for service consistency in order to minimize service disruption. So these are vendors where we have conducted reviews, but it's been a while since we've conducted those reviews. I'm sorry, and the last comment is not applicable, meaning these were vendors that the district has used as a fiscal agent for pass-through payments on those last two you see on the slide.
So, Zays, are you when you said that you haven't conducted any reviews, are you thinking of putting those into the work plan?
I'll have Jeff comment on that.
Yes, Chair Groom, exactly. We've got an informal process for revisiting RFPs, and management judgment is part of that, and management judgment is good, but we are talking about formalizing that a little more.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So for slide 13, a question was raised on how the 2017 wildfires affected the district's property tax revenue. We thought it would be helpful to provide a breakdown of the property tax revenue received by county during fiscal year 17-18 and compare it to the initial budget. Overall, revenues exceeded the initial budget by 5%. Sonoma was the only county where actual revenues came in slightly lower than the budget at 98%. It's important to note that both Sonoma and Napa counties received relief from the state for the loss of property tax revenue resulting from the 2017 wildfires. So due to this relief from the state, the district received payment from both counties in December to offset that lost revenue. The district's lost revenue for Sonoma was estimated at $30,000. And for Napa, it was $9,000. The final slide here addresses questions of staffing breakdown by the general fund and grant funds. The top table shows the 2019 budget, FTEs, and as you can see, there's a total of 405 FTE positions. And the general fund represents 365, and the grant fund represents 40. The bottom table shows the currently filled FTE positions, and currently the general fund currently funds 321 of those positions, and the grant fund currently funds 30 of those positions for a total of 351 positions. And this concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Any questions? Secretary Chavez?
Thank you very much. So first of all, thank you for being so responsive to all of our questions. And this is a really helpful breakdown as a way to look at our budget. I wanted to go back, if I could, to slide 12. And this is the vendor request for proposal, the second slide that you use there. And one request I would have is that I actually do think that there's a benefit to having a formalized process and occasionally to do open requests for proposals or requests for qualifications, not necessarily just an RFP. And one of the things that I'm sort of struck by is that there are sometimes where we really don't have options. And frankly, I think once we get into some of our IT purchases, I feel like we're just stuck, for lack of a better word. But for other kinds of purchases, you know, everything from legal even to phone service are opportunities both for us to look at cost savings, but even to look at improved partnerships. And I'm thinking about that in particular with legal. So I really am interested in understanding if we could create a more formal process that by every X number of years we really are going out to bid. I just think it's good practice and would like to see us do that.
Absolutely, I think that's great direction, Director Chavez.
And then the second part of that, and I guess you can come back to us at a future time with what you think that looking at what a best practice would be for that, maybe even talking to our auditors about that may be of value. And then the second thing I wanted to just mention, I know my colleagues have had this experience that often you'll see on your agenda, not even just here, but in your other, wearing your other hats, where you have an extension of a contract. Maybe it's a no-cost extension or there's a cost extension because we've worked to the end of the contract and then we're trying to figure out what the next steps are. And one request I would have is that we create just an early warning so that when we know we're 6 months out, that either that gets the committee gets alerted that we're not doing an RFP or an RFQ for some reason because maybe you just have a little bit of work that needs to get done, or that the staff is opting to continue the contract for a specific reason. And the reason I mention this is that, again, while I haven't seen it here, I'm being more protective of the organization, is that I've been surprised at how often we've exceeded the initial intent around a contract, and by the time we're looking at it a third time, we're in the hundreds of thousands or the millions of dollars, even though that's not where we started our relationship, and then we get into a situation where we're not bidding that contract anymore. And it feels like a very backwards way of getting into what should be a more thoughtful kind of a more thoughtful, transparent approach to how we partner with the business community or with other nonprofits. So those would just be two requests for future feedback from the staff. But I really am appreciative. This was much easier to look at. Thank you.
Thank
Director
you.
Sinks.
Thank you. If we flip to slide 5, I noted it looks like we're doing pretty well against the budget. We're at 53% of budgeted expenditures. Is that where you'd expect to be at this point?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yep. So I was looking at the financial statements for 2018 and noted that we were 23% under where the final budget had put us. Can you talk to us a bit about why our budget was so rich compared to actuals, and whether or not you think is that a recurring pattern here?
So a large part of that is going to be money that's already obligated but not yet spent. I'll let Stephanie talk about that a little more.
Sure. That's correct. So we do have some prior year, what we call encumbrances, that carry over to the current year. And some of it was really related to, the Clean Air Awards, as well as TIO, where the board had approved some of those expenditures, but it's just carrying over because that has not been spent yet. So those are some of the grant awards that carried over.
Well, the TIO was really small. I mean, I'm seeing, $374,000, I guess, against a budget of $700,000. So, I mean, the difference for last fiscal year was $24,700,000. Is that really all mostly encumbrances?
So I'm not sure what page you're looking at, but that's the operation part of the TIO. But there are other grants that...
I mean, for the budget overall. So I was looking at, the statement of expenditures in 2018 and trying to figure out if, are we always substantially underspending our budget year over year, or...
No, I think this was a unique one, unique year this year. We're not substantially under. It's just that there were a few, again, budgeted items that carried over to this year because of those significant approvals that were made for some of the grants that we haven't yet completed.
So I apologize. This is my first time, first meeting that I'm at of this committee. And my other basic question is, in looking at the amount that we're spending on the executive office, finance, and administration, it's comprising about 26% of the budget. Is that what you would expect if we're looking for cost recovery? Would it make more sense to allocate funds to the specific functions that might allow us to do so? I mean, it just struck me as large for functions that might properly be or could be allocated as overhead into, you know, our major functional areas, compliance, engineering, planning, research, et cetera.
That's a very good point, Director Sinks. 1 month from now, we'll be bringing the first pass of the 2020 budget to this committee.
Okay.
And that actually would be a perfect time to address those specific questions that you're bringing up.
I'm sorry. I was trying to figure out where I might make a remark in this agenda, and it's a little off point to the second quarter results. Thank you.
Director Mischoff?
Thank you. And I want to second Director Sinks. I'm sorry we were having a whispered conversation, but he was trying to ascertain that. I want to also join with Director Chavez on the slide 12 and the RFPs. I don't think you have to reinvent the wheel. I know our county looks at an every three-year, not just our county, but as I mentioned in the previous item, there are a number of regional bodies that's sort of the standard, unless there is a significant reason not to. And I'll give you another example, lobbying. At least for Contra Costa County, as part of the Delta County Coalition, we had a three-year RFP 5 years ago. But we are continuing that contract because it is such a complex issue, and we were right at a turning point, especially with the new governor coming in. So that was one reason for staff to come back, and we had a full transparent conversation about it. But we do trust management. I know you mentioned it with management review before, but again, just want to let you know that I think there are a number of counties out there and other agencies that do that. And as to slide 13, and I appreciate the property tax information, I know that the state did provide relief for those counties, but I'm not sure we can plan on it in the future, and Supervisor Wagon Connect is down there and may be able to speak to the NAPA. I'm still surprised that we got more than we thought we would get from NAPA, because when I sit with my ABAG colleagues, especially on housing issues and moving forward, we're hearing dire, dire stories. So as you prepare the budget, I'm not sure how you can predict what the, I guess it would be 1920 tax rolls will show, but I'm not sure, maybe Brad can speak to this, he may be getting more information from his own assessor, that we can rely on getting, at least in Napa's situation, at least 100%, and in Sonoma's only 2% less than 100%. I think we need to be very, very mindful of that. And thank you.
Karen, it's my understanding that generally our staff does a check-in with the various counties on property tax and how it's growing or not growing during the course of each year, several times.
Ours has been very predictable. That we had a 5% bump with the loss, but some of that was made up by the state, and then we've got a lot of growth going on right now. Downtown.
Director Canepa.
Great, thank you very much, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to thank Jeff. I want to thank Stephanie for all your wonderful work. You know, we had talked earlier about the fee schedule, the implementation of that previous. I think that was really, really helpful in terms of budget. I guess one of the things that I would encourage staff to look into is to see if there are further opportunities around a stationary source. And I don't know if you've lent more thought to that, if that is going to come, before the board. And just wanted to kind of get your sort of insight to when you're going to sort of reassess and reevaluate stationary source and maybe potentially an increase in fees, or I just want to kind of get the, you know, the temperature on that.
Yes, Director Canepa, we will be bringing the fee schedule to the March Budget and Finance Committee. So in 1 month, you'll see changes to the fee schedule, including changes to stationary sources. And actually, we already started workshopping those changes. So those proposals are out there. And if you like, I can send you a link to quite a bit of information on that.
You know, if you could do that, that would be that would be incredible. Thank you for all your hard work, Jeff. Okay, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Bowders.
Thank you. I want to thank you, Stephanie and Jeff, for a very good report, comprehensive. I just had a couple quick questions. I noted at the end you mentioned that we have about 53 or 54 vacancies at the time that the financials was done.
Yeah.
And so following on slide six, you talked about the personnel salaries being over last year's budgeted amount because we made increases to benefits. And then on slide five, we're actually still under expenditure. So I've assumed that that's due to the vacancies. And my question is just, do we have a anticipated timeline for filling those vacancies? Is that going to be in quarters three and four of this year, some portion of those? What are those vacancies and what is the timeline for them?
The vacancies topic is complicated as it's across many different programs. And I think to really do justice to that excellent question, I'd ask to come back with that information during the budget process.
That's fine. Thank you.
Director Ross.
Thank you. Apologies for being late. A lot of traffic. Just as a kind of an idea or a guide as to our performance, to speak to Director Sink's question about, you know, how much are we spending versus how much we budgeted. Is there a way to not spend a lot of time on it, but to go over at our next meeting or in the near future, like the last 5 years of, you know, budgeted, your budget projections versus the actuals, the audited actuals. So you can see whether, and I know every year has different exigencies that would cause some aberrations. You know, you have things pop up and expenditures pop up, but you might get a general, I guess, looking for a general feel of our accuracy in projecting our actual needs.
Certainly, Director Ross, I'd be happy to do that during the budget presentation in 1 month.
Yeah, it would just be a good idea to see how we're faring in our projections. Thanks.
Anyone else? Okay. Oh, Director Hudson. Didn't see you there.
Can you go back to the total property tax? Yeah, there you go. This ends June 30th. Are you taking this effective as what date?
I'm sorry. This is covering the actual revenues received in fiscal year 2018. So I wanted to take a look at the entire fiscal year. So June 30th, 2018. Correct.
Okay. Because I know I'm looking at these things and we're talking up here. I mean, it's not hard to understand how San Francisco got that high. But I look back and I guess because I was thinking for the whole year of what went on in my city, just my city alone, we were up 5%, and we're the largest property tax evaluation in Contra Costa County. And I'm trying to figure out how in the heck could we only be up 2%? And now the only reason I think it was because the construction might have been finished. I think it's along the lines that when you bring this to people here, we might want to do a little bit of our own checking what the heck these numbers are. They seemed odd to me. I mean, I was talking to Cindy here. Santa Clara didn't add any. So, you guys were great with Santa Clara.
Yeah,
it's based on our budget.
The projection was closer, but it's worth the biggest influence on how these numbers play out is property turnover. Yeah. So that when you reassess a property that last sold in, say, 1977, and then got its Prop 13 adjustment. To the modern value, which in many cases is multiples of what it was sold for the last time it was sold and therefore evaluated, there's a big jump. So even if, and we found this during the recession, when real estate wasn't going gangbusters, there were still properties turning over and with the reevaluated number significantly higher than the last time it was put on the rolls. And so that's the big influence. And so when you look at these numbers, I think anything within that range of up to like 10% is probably okay, just because it's very difficult to say how much turnover you're going to get year over year.
Yeah, I get the turnover thing, and during the recession, our assessor assessed a few cities very low. Mm-hmm. My city didn't go down at all, but the biggest difference wasn't so much in the turnover of the houses. It was that when people were buying new housing, it and throughout the construction, and we had we still have a couple of subdivisions going, but the bigger one had to be the commercial end of it. When you buy an AT&T building of 1.6 million square feet, and it's been there since Prop 13, it's supposed to go up.
Yeah, it's not just residential. You're absolutely right. It's on the commercial side too. But all of those pieces play in. And what we found was that we did not see a big dip in our property tax revenue, which is set by formula now, post Prop 13. There isn't a We don't make an estimate and then people come back and tell us what they're going to give us. It's just set by formula. And so it tracks whatever's happening in the county revenue stream.
Director Ross?
It is, to speak to these projections, it's very, let's just say, deceptive in looking at the numbers, because there's so many factors in every different county. In Contra Costa, as Dave just alluded, the assessor, for good reason, knocked the values down, but he may have done so a little more than other assessors might have in another county. In Napa, you're wondering, well, that's 104%. Well, really, that's $40,000 is over, and that's really nothing. And that could be, as Brad had said, they're downtown, and I assume he's saying downtown Napa City proper is doing very well, but don't forget they had an earthquake. And so values went down, mm-hmm. and then suddenly values go back up, yeah. because things got fixed again. And this would be about the time frame that you'd realize those renewed values. And Sonoma and the Napa fires will probably have the same rebound effect at some point.
Anyone else? All right. So to kind of recap, we're gonna take a look at contracting and vendors and see if we can't put a system together or a plan together to do reviews at an earlier time. We're going to take a look at the scribbling here. John, you wrote it down. We're going to take a look at vacancies and make that a little more clear when we look at personnel again, when we look at the general fund expenditures. And I think those were the two biggest things that we were going to try to take a more careful look at.
Thank you, Chair Groom. And I also had a note from Director Ross to look at 5 years of budget to actual.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you, Stephanie.
And I might just ask, when you do that, show us the things that are the carryovers, right? What fraction are carryovers? That would be most helpful.
Thank you very much, Stephanie.
Thank you.
We're going to go to item number 6, which is the Air District Economic Outlook.
Thank you, Chair Groom, members of the committee. I want to do a brief introduction for our economist here, Mr. Leonid Bach. I spoke at the last committee meeting a month ago about how important our ability to do modeling was during the last downturn, because we gradually drew down reserves over multiple years, and our ability to do that in a controlled manner and to some extent predict the future was really critical. So we're starting to expose a little more of the detail of how we do that modeling to the committee. And I just want to say that we're really pleased to have our economist, Mr. Leonid Bach, have joined us just a few months ago. He was previously at the World Bank and with the state of Hawaii. And at the board meeting offsite, Mr. Bach showed about 5 slides that talked about how we see the Bay Area economy going, and even putting that in the context of the country as a whole. And since those 5 slides were so well received, we thought we'd up it to 10 today for the Budget and Finance Committee. And if that continues to be of interest, I think we can go to 40 or 50 possibly. So anyway, Mr. Bach.
Good morning. So in for the economic overview today, I'm going to focus on three areas: the general economic outlook, labor market, and population and housing. So let's start with the overview of the economy. So as we look at the stock market performance and how it sort of reflects the broader economy, the year ended negatively for most stock exchanges. And most notably, publicly listed large home builder companies lost over 33% of their stock value due to housing market slowdown in the second half of the year. This is reflecting the higher interest rates and therefore rising mortgage rates. Energy companies lost over 20% in their stock values due to lower energy prices and lower overall demand for energy for both cars and industrial clients. Industrial companies lost about 15% of their stock value, mostly due to trade issues, disputes, trade wars, taxes and tariffs. And financial companies, the main reason there for losses was higher interest rates, lower lower number of loans, and so therefore lower business, and that kind of resulted in negative for the year for financial companies. The pharmaceuticals were the only industry that grew by about 5% for the year. Other than that, everything was either at best zero or negative. So when we look at the Bay Area's economic performance compared to the country as a whole or the state of California, one thing to note here is that our region's economic performance is characterized by sharper peaks. So that means that the economy is doing very well when things are going well, but lower values. See the shaded area around 2008-09, that's the recession. And you see that the region lost more in economic output than either the state or the country. But starting from 2010 up until including 2018, although we don't have the final data on that, we've been on this really nice ride of expanding economic output. The risks, though, remain as there's a buildup of, for most people think, a moderate slowdown, hopefully, rather than a sharp decline as we saw in 2008 or 9. As far as the recession, there's just a new poll released today by S&P Global, and for North America, about 55% of the economists think that recession is going to start in 2020. However, about 45% of the economists think that the recession has either already started or will start in 2019. So that's the data just released today by S&P Global. For the labor market, or looking at the U.S. economy from the view of the labor market, we see that in 2018, there was a very steady expansion in payrolls, and that resulted in rising wage growth. Typically, economists assume full employment where there is an unemployment rate of about 4%. 4% is needed for a normal labor turnover and to keep wages from spiraling out of control. Average unemployment rate for 2018 for the whole year was 4.3% in California. When the rate is below 4%, which is sort of less than full employment or more than full employment, and it's happening in many countries, in many parts of the country, including in the Bay Area. So for 2018, the average for San Francisco, San Jose area is about 2.7. So this lower unemployment rate means pressures on employers to raise wages because it's hard to find qualified workers. So as a result, inflation for wage workers in our area stayed above 4% in the second half of 2018. Additionally, for the labor market, what's happening over the last 15 years, you see that there is a shift away from manufacturing. Manufacturing industry lost about 24% of the jobs over 15 years. This is number of this is total employment numbers by industry. But education, healthcare expanded. This really shows what were the main industries and how they recompositions themselves due to innovation, other changes. What is interesting, also this is related to that to the previous slide, is that and this slide shows the cumulative change in earnings per worker by industry in the Bay Area. So this is not real wages, but it's sort of a standardized measure to compare the industries. And as you see, information is a far away leader, and this is due to the fact that the industry is an innovation leader, and it's as you see in the previous slide, it didn't add too many jobs, but that's because it's very effective. So it's efficient economically. So it gets to, you know, the job done with fewer people for more wages. That's really the economics behind it. While the number of people employed in, for example, real estate, which seems like the wages didn't really improve much, it's to better understand it, industries that are that pay the most, they typically are the leaders in worker productivity improvements, so efficiency, innovation, and so on. However, some of the industries with the lower or lowest productivity scores, such as education and healthcare. So in education and healthcare, there haven't really been all that much improvements in terms of efficiency. But the wages nevertheless didn't stay where they were in 2001. They still rose. And that's the phenomenon that economists call that when there is a leading industry in the area, the wages are going to rise across the board regardless, even though the rest of the industries don't innovate as much. And that's really what's happening with education and healthcare, that even though there really isn't much innovation there, but because there are some leaders, leader industries in the area, wages there will rise as well. So moving to the population and housing part, in 2017 and very likely 2018 as well, even more so than 2017, however, the data is not yet available fully. The Bay Area region grew considerably slower than it did in the earlier part of the decade. The main reason for the sharply slowing population growth rates is migration from California to other states. So net migration to other parts of the U.S. was more than 100,000 people. So 100,000 people more left than came in 2015, 16, and 17, according to the Census Bureau. So, and the total immigration from California to other states between 2006 and 17 was just under 1.25 million, according to the Census Bureau. So this is the nation's third highest rates of out-migration, behind only New York and Illinois. The reason total population growth is still possible, and we see positive numbers, we're not negative, is due to natural growth, births, and foreign immigration to California. So in part, it reflects unaffordable housing for many households in the area, forcing many households to move either to the neighboring metro areas or out of the state entirely. Other reasons for moving outside the states included high taxes and utilities. And the housing prices really are hitting all records, as you see by on average last year, four counties had had a median sales price above $1.2 million. And however, it should be noted that in the second half of the year, the number of sales slowed considerably. The reason for the slowing sales was rising mortgage rates. And as you see here, in November of last year, average mortgage rates went above 5%, which is an important psychological threshold for many. However, since the beginning of the year, they have come down from the 5%. I think they average now around 4.34, something like that. And many areas around the country experienced a slowdown in real estate activity, especially the pricier areas around Manhattan, Boston, Seattle, Miami, and Southern California. And just this morning's release, just to add here, the National Association of Realtors said that the January 19 data for pending home sales across the country, the index of pending home sales went up 4.6% because of lower mortgage rates for January compared to December, but the index is still down 2.3% compared to last year. And notably, the Western states, the pending sales index fell by over 10% compared to a year ago. So this index, pending home sales index, is a leading indicator for the housing sector. So this is, it kind of shows the direction where the housing sector is going. Another thing that they noted in that release this morning was that it seems like many areas around the country, the number of homes for sale have increased, so the inventories have increased, and that shows that people are really rushing to sell at the top of the market. Maybe one indication. So how does our Bay Area real estate market compared to the United States average? So historically, you see that there have been a couple of bubbles. One was in the mid-90s, leading up to the dot-com peak and crash, and then again the financing bubble, mid-2000s, followed by relatively lengthy decline and recession, and then again picking up around 2011-12, and now we are at historically all-time highs. So this currently where we are, we're about five times the median, so the average price, selling price in the Bay Area is about five times more than national. And the trend may revert itself, as you see historically it did. How far and how long, that's an open question. Nobody really knows the answer to that. But the fact that it may revert, that's pretty clear historically. And then finally, what are the housing needs for the Bay Area? So this is a very simple household growth forecast by county. And the reason households growth is forecast is because typically economists assume that it's households that need housing, not single individuals. So it's not predicting population as a whole, but households. And the trends are such that over the next 10 years, we should expect roughly 200,000 additional households. That's assuming that the conditions that were over the previous 10 years hold in the next 10 years. And that would bring the total number of households in the Bay Area by 2028 to around just under 3 million, up to 2.9 million from about 2.7 in 2017. Note that unless there's a serious structural change in the population composition that may affect household formation in the region, Napa County is not expected really to add any households Marine very slightly, but the more the sort of the counties with most households added are going to be Alameda and Santa Clara. Some of the fastest growing counties percentage wise are Solano and San Francisco. So that's really where we're headed. Hopefully, I mean, depending on whether or not the conditions that were there over the last 10 years will hold into the future as well. So that concludes my presentation. Do you have any questions?
Questions for Mr. Bach? Thank you.
Sure.
Item number 7 is our continued discussion on the Air District's financial plan.
Thank you, Chair Groom, members of the committee. This will be brief. It's just a small subset of what was shown a month ago with some elements that are intended to be responsive to some of the questions that came up. For context, then, what we've done historically is mid-year, which is more or less where we are. So December, January, we've done a financial state of the district presentation to this committee. And the slides that are used in that provide context then for the budget process that follows. And those slides sort of comprised a resource. So what we did was, with for the first time with last month's meeting, we not only just showed slides about the state of the district financially, we also created a little document, in a sense, out of those slides as a resource and called it our financial plan. I indicated at the time it's probably a little bit of a grand name for that small document, but we think it'll grow into it over the years. What I'd like to do today is just revisit a couple of the topics that were brought up during last month's meeting. And in particular, there were questions about our policies on targets for fees and for financing our or funding our unfunded liabilities. And I'll talk briefly about those policies again, with a particular point about how soon we would need to change those policies if the board wanted to change them. And I'll just spoil the surprise by saying that, you know, for this upcoming budget cycle, the policies as they are, increasing them would not change the result of what we'd be doing in this budget cycle, at least. And then there were a couple questions about a couple other small things like AB 617, which I'll talk about. So let me start first with our cost recovery policy. Fortunately, a while back, we put this policy in place to reach at least 85 minimum. And again, we're allowed by law to recover 100% of the costs of our core businesses, our core processes, sorry. And so for some time, we've been doing predictable, not overly large, well, depending on who you ask, I suppose, fee increases, but predictable, consistent fee increases over a number of years, moving towards this 85% minimum. I want to point out that the policy does not preclude going above 85%. It just says let's get to at least 85%. We are getting, with the last numbers that we ran, we're quite close to 85%, but that's with a very large vacancy rate. So we're going to have to sort of run fast just to stay in place, so to speak, on that. So we anticipate coming forward again with another 6.4% increase to continue trying to get to and stay at 85%. This is an illustration over several years of how we've been doing with cost recovery. I'll just point out that, you know, when you're down near 50% cost recovery, it's a tough hole to get out of because there's a limit on how much we can increase fees every year, and it's a percentage limit. So our general counsel may remember the number. I think it's 15%. If we're at only 50% cost recovery, and we can only increase by 15%, if you see what I'm saying, you're only making 7.5% impact. So it's not good to be down that low. Let's talk about OPEB. OPEB's a good story. We had a very large obligation back in 2008 and absolutely zero funding. We've now got $40 million in the bank as of our last view of those numbers on a $58 million obligation. We are funding that aggressively as we have for several years. We'll come forward once again in the upcoming budget with a $4 million discretionary fund recommendation. There's a 90% funded level target right now. At this rate, this aggressive rate, will probably be there around fiscal year ending 2022. The great thing about that is we all know that the CalPERS requirements are going to go up. And since this $4 million, we've been doing it so long, it's practically just it's structural part of our budget. You can think of that $4 million as being something we could then redirect to the CalPERS issue once we get past 2022. That's not something we're asking the board to approve now. It's not been brought forward to the board for approval. It's just I'm just bringing that idea up now so that it's not a new idea in 2022. The question did come up, and it's an interesting question about how much does it help to fund obligations as they accrue? And this chart's meant to be responsive to that. There are a lot of different ways to think about that. I mean, in the most obvious sense, making promises now that future boards have to figure out how to pay for can be problematic. This is just an illustration of what would have happened if we had funded, as we did, starting in 2008, but if we had not put that into an OPEB trust, but rather had put it into what's essentially a zero earnings pool with the county. And it's pretty substantial. So even if we had funded as we did, at the rate that we did, if we had not gone with an OPEB trust, that's $13 million. And again, we're a $100 million organization, so that's a pretty significant amount of money. That's $13 million we wouldn't have if we hadn't pre-funded into the OPEB trust. Pension, again, it's just a review of the policy conversation. There's a current policy in place to try to get to 95% funding. And right now we've projected that if we put in an extra million every year, which is what we'll do again in the upcoming budget, we'll get to there in around 20 years. Of course, if we wish to, as we discussed, redirect that $4 million in a few years, then we could get there more quickly. Relative to the upcoming budget cycle, though, the question was, should we change that policy? Well, we're not currently getting close to reaching that 90% rate, so it wouldn't necessarily influence what we would do in the upcoming budget cycle. This slide's responsive to the question about AB 617. The question was, the state's given us $4.8 million. How does that compare to what our actual costs are going to be? And this may be a little more detail than is really necessary. The bottom line is, of the 4.8 that we've received, we still have about 1.3 we haven't spent as of February 16th. Given the amount of time we still have left in the fiscal year before the end of June, we'll certainly spend more than that 1.3, but not by a large amount. That's not a financial term. It'll probably be less than $1 million over, let's say. We're just not in a position to project that number right now, but obviously in a few months we'll be able to come back with something more specific. We have been promised 4.8 in the upcoming fiscal year as well. After that, we will see, but we have some folks trying to work on that. Next steps in March, the first presentation of the budget and the fees, and in April, the second presentation with the opportunity to refer the budget to the board. And that's my presentation.
Questions for Mr. McKay? Mr. Bowders?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is a really great turnaround over looking back at what you've done on the OPEB. I just wanted to, with the chair and the committee's blessing, recommend as something, as you mentioned, not to be done during this budget cycle, but perhaps to put on a 12-month timeline for review. What you did with the OPEB trust, a 115 trust, I think is the right way to for public agencies these days to make financial investments for the future. I think that was a prudent move, and I think when we look at reaching that funding threshold that we're setting for OPEB in the next couple of years, it would be prudent of us to evaluate whether or not a 115 trust for the CalPERS investment is the right way to go. And I think seeing the moderate recession that is looming, depending on which side of the nickel you're voting with, 2019 or 20, I think having taken those steps while times are good to plan for that, and then to be able to invest when the market is down into something that we control. The state has a history of shooting itself in appendages and making political choices about what investments should look like. Mm-hmm. And if you don't cut the head off of a dragon, the dragon doesn't die, it burns you. So I kind of feel that there's a need for us to yeah, I'm on the metaphor, so I'll move to sports later, to move in that direction and have that conversation, because I think there's an opportunity to really come out on top during the bottom of the market if we continue with this discretionary funding plan, but move it into a space where we are in the driver's seat about what we're doing. And I think recent news about California CalPERS being invested in tabloids in New York demonstrates that there will most likely be a future legislative appetite to further play with money politically, and that's dangerous to public agencies as the discount rate continues to go down.
For the rest of the committee, Vice Chair Bowders and I had a meeting with Mr. McKay to set the tone for this year's budget, and we did ask him to take a look at alternatives to CalPERS, which we looked at a couple of years ago, and to keep us posted on alternative ways to manage our pensions. I'll get to you, Director Ross.
Yeah, the just on the OPEB trust, the $13 million, I mean, how much was our portion of this building?
Yeah, this building costs us $29
million. Okay. So, well, we got a discount anyway.
Director
Mischoff. But I support the chair and the vice chair's direction.
Director Mischoff.
Thank you. Going back to slide 3, where we talk about cost recovery, and I, too, understand the issues when we were so far in the hole and we're coming out, and I know we've discussed this at previous meetings, but we did have a public speaker say that they've exceeded, and when I heard that, it sort of set off a red flag, because I'm thinking, no, it hasn't. Can you explain, have some fees exceeded in certain areas, or because overall, my understanding is they have not, based on what staff has presented, but could you address that, because that is not my understanding.
Certainly, Director Mischoff. So the 85% target is a blended target, and we actually have a large number of specific fee schedules. And some of those are over 85% or some are under. And
but I'm sorry to interrupt, but they increase if they're over 85 only at that small percentage that we by policy allow, correct?
That's correct, and that percentage change is specific to each specific fee
okay.
schedule. Right. So when we bring the fees forward in March, you'll see that we're recommending some fees go up by a certain percentage, some fees go up not at all, some fees go up by a larger percentage. So it depends on the rate of cost recovery for those fees. And frankly, also, to some extent, there's been concern about some of the smaller businesses in the Bay Area, and whether we, you know, want to increase the fees on those small business owners as much as might be suggested by the simple percentages. So it can be a little complicated. Yeah.
So again, this is a composite
yes.
of all of our fees and
yeah.
trying to dig ourselves out of that hole,
yeah.
and that compositely we will be at an 85% cost recovery. But some fees are above 85% cost recovery just because you've come to this board and we've given policy direction, and it's at a specific percentage based on that policy direction.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. Director Hudson?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's missed in that question that was brought up, when we go to the top end of where we're increasing the fees, and it really caught my attention over the last 8 years, at 9%, we're doubling these people's fees in 8 years. And then you turn around and continue at 9, you're going to double them again. And that's where it starts to get a little tough. So we'll probably be walking along. I know I can see Director Canepa shaking his head. We were looking at, okay, can we go to some of the people that are a little over and kind of somehow smooth out this, I call it 6.3% or the blended rate that we're looking at to make it a little bit more tolerable for the smaller businesses that find this to be more difficult. The other thing, and I want to put in my two cents and make it four, shifting gears, is that OPEB. I can't tell you as a city that for the first time was over 100% funded on OPEB. I'd really like to stay with this for 3 years.
Absolutely.
And reach that in that 2022. I don't mind flipping over, and I can remember just the opposite, I think, when Ash Caller and I were fighting for to get this thing started. It makes a difference when you can say 100%. I don't know what it is, psychological or whatever, but it makes a difference.
I want to go back and expand a little bit on the cost recovery. When we started this cost recovery thing a number of years ago, we did continue to look at the actual cost of our operation that go into the fees. So it's not just being plucked out of the air. There's a lot of numbers that go into that.
I just wanted to
make sure everybody was aware of that, because some of you are new, and when we started this, some of us were younger. committee member comments, item number 9.
Yes.
Please, Director Sinks.
So, to my earlier point about administration, executive, that overhead is not factored into costs for the... It is.
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we take our total budget, well, some substantial fraction of our budget, and we allocate that overhead to the services we provide.
That's exactly. Direct and indirect costs both.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what fraction of the agency's work is considered to be part of our cost basis?
Mm.
Are there exceptions?
Yeah. It's Director Sinks, to do a good job with that question, I'll have to come back to you on that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
But basically, our target is 85% of our total expenditures.
Of our allowed expenditures for the core programs, permitting and enforcement, that sort of thing. Direct and indirect.
Right. The program's attributable to stationary source regulation, because we have programs that aren't, and those don't get charged
mobile
off
source grants, all that. So
right.
It
those
is
don't get charged off against the stationary source program.
So right. It's everything associated with stationary source regulation, fees, permitting, as well as some allocation of our overhead.
Exactly. Yeah. And yep. Some of the planning and that sort of work that relates to the stationary source side.
Coming up with the regulations in the first place.
Exactly.
Thank you.
I neglected item 8, so is there public comment on the non-agenda items? Okay. Time and place of our next meeting is March the 22nd, and unless there's other business, we'll adjourn.